Welcome to the Discover Film Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Howard. This podcast is happening because I program two film festivals, and the Q&A session after every film is always cut short. I was looking for a way to talk to these filmmakers without a time limit, and a podcast just seemed like a good solution. One requirement is that the film we discuss has to be available to the public. That way, after listening to the podcast, you can watch the movie. And if you're super cool, you'll watch the film first so that it's more like the film festival experience where you watch the movie and then you hear how it got made. Got it? All right. This first Discover Film podcast features Jamie Brindle. He wrote, directed, and edited the short film The Catcher. I first saw The Catcher at the festival Film Invasion LA, and you can watch The Catcher right now if you go to discoverfilm.net or filminvasionla.com. Without a time limit, Jamie and I kind of went overboard. We talked for an hour and a half, so this podcast is actually an edit of the conversation. The full conversation will be available too for those of you who totally geek out over filmmaking. All right, that's enough preamble. Let's talk to Jamie.
Hi, yeah, it's going.
We are going. So this is the first ever
awesome
Discover Film podcast.
Like it. Yeah, it's an honor. Honor to be here.
And it's Jamie Brindle is here.
Yeah.
Who I met at Film Invasion LA in 2016.
When we were young men.
You are still a young man. You are a very young man.
No, that was a blast. We had a blast there. And yeah, it's good Q&As too. That's on you. That's good.
All I do is I stay out of the way.
Yeah.
I ask about the film. Well, I help choose the film.
Yeah.
And your film, The Catcher, is a great film. And
Thank you.
I just stay out of the way and say, where'd you come up with this? But before we talk about where The Catcher came from, and we are going to discuss The Catcher, and we're going to tell people where to watch it online.
Okay.
First, tell me your background.
Oh, man.
When did you come to L.A.?
Yeah, I came to L.A. Coming on, I think, 6 years ago. I came from Virginia. I was born and raised in Richmond, Virginia, where I actually did a lot of acting growing up. So I started off as a professional stage actor and was just, you know, the kid in all the shows in Richmond. So,
But getting paid.
Yeah, getting paid. Yeah.
It's pretty exciting
yeah,
for a kid.
It was not bad. You know, and it helped me buy my first car and all that stuff, you know, and I would transition into commercials every now and then and, you know, be on a commercial or be on a radio spot or something. And so, you know, and that experience has helped me now that I'm, you know, working with actors because I kind of know where they're coming from. I mean, I was a 12-year-old in musical theater. It's a little different, but I can kind of relate. But no, when I started doing commercials, I kind of had this, I guess, spark point, you know, when I saw how it's done with takes and lighting and, you know, versus just a live theater experience where you rehearse for several weeks and then, you know, you go. And that, I think I really fell for it then. And I worked with a director in Richmond, who does a lot of work in Richmond, Jerry Williams, who, kind of, you know, took me under his wing and showed me the ropes while I was in some of his commercials. And, we had a high school in Richmond that specialized in film production. So it was like you could take this track of classes where you learn, if you have a history project, make a documentary. You know, if you have a science project, you make a website or something. So they teach you all the media. And so that just kind of built my strengths and my knowledge. It's called the Mass Comm Center in Manchester High. And so Mass Comm really kind of got me comfortable with a camera, and from there it was just, you know.
And you got hooked.
Up to the races, yeah.
And I suppose at your wedding there's going to be video of you as a kid.
Yeah, probably.
That most people don't have.
Yeah, without a doubt, yeah. There's a lot of footage out there. There's a great Star Wars short film produced in in elementary school that'll probably make it.
That's
way
very cool. I actually promised myself we wouldn't talk Star Wars.
Yeah, it's how long is this podcast? We'll
actually,
go forever.
We could possibly do a separate podcast just discussing Star Wars.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I feel like Star Wars is for generations now of filmmakers is the moment that a filmmaker knew he wanted to be a filmmaker. You know, it's. I say, you know, probably from when it came out on.
Yeah, actually, that's an interesting question. So when you were doing films, doing stage plays, and then doing commercials and right. on set, you're young, so Star Wars was already out. So when did seeing it actually affect you that much as far as filmmaking goes, or were you already on that track?
I can actually pinpoint. I remember seeing it. I was like in first grade, or, you know, this was, it had been long out of theaters, and I remember really wanting to see it, not knowing anything about it, but like being really infatuated with already then. I mean, I didn't know that it was the concept of world building and, you know, creating a universe, but that was really cool to me. And I remember watching it and just freaking out. Like, it was just the coolest thing I'd ever seen, you know? And it's just, I just think that it's very imaginative and it's excellent storytelling. And
you saw the first one first.
I saw A New Hope first.
Four.
Yeah, I saw A New Hope. And
there was a good adult around somehow, yeah. If that was the first one you saw.
Yeah. Dad made sure. Yeah. No, it was good. I remember I had found a little Chewbacca toy before I saw it, and I was like, I think this guy's the main character or something, you know? And Dad goes, all right, let's watch this movie.
He's not the main character. He didn't even speak.
All right, kids, time to watch this movie.
Yeah, that's excellent. So then you'd already been on sets, and then you see what can be done.
Yeah.
And so that high school you went to.
Yeah.
Does it just gears everyone to study film as an undergrad?
Or? Yeah. I mean, it's paced at, you know, they aim you at a couple different media routes, right? You know, journalism is an angle, film is an angle, graphic design, things like that. So it's kind of what you do in college, only I did it in high school. And because of that, then when I got to college, you know, I had already beefed up my skill set to where I got to go. I went and employed it in, you know, I started a little business making commercials and stuff and just practicing and honing my craft. And then, you know, then I moved out to L.A. shortly after.
Right after college.
Yeah.
What university was it?
James Madison. In Virginia, yeah.
And is their film program very practical based or theory based, or is it a balance?
It's practical. They have guys there that have won, you know, daytime Emmys and stuff that are professors, and so they kind of they have the gear and the, you know, so some of the cooler classes I took there were like adaptation classes, like where you would read the book and then watch the movie and then really study, okay, like why did they condense these three characters into this one? How did they choose that? You know, because there's so much more a book can do than a movie. But yeah, you learn a lot about what what it's like to adapt something. So that was a cool class. I liked anything where we were watching and studying movies. I think I responded more to, and I think that's probably because I was so comfortable with a camera already.
By the way, that's very cool that you studied adaptation, because I don't know all your work, but The Catcher that I know is a historical adaptation.
Yeah.
And done extremely well. So, so kudos to that professor. Because I think most people really blow the adaptation thing.
Yeah.
Especially first try. I mean, even pros.
Yeah, it's tricky. And also because, you know, more often than not, you've got a fan base. You have to, an established fan base that you have to keep happy with the adaptation. So you're almost screwed from the start, you know. But I think the history now, like turning history into cinema, there's something about it that it's to me, it's just built in thrills, you know, because you're going, wow, this really happened. I can't believe that, you know. And I think that adds stakes that you might have to establish in something that's not fact-based, you know, when you realize, okay, these are real people, so you don't have to convince an audience that these are real people, because it's already done for you.
Yeah, and the stakes involved in a historical event are major.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not like the audience can look at it and go, well, someone just made this up.
Yeah, exactly. And especially something like The Catcher, where people don't know the outcome, because nobody really, you know, has ever heard of Mo Berg, or at least that's what I kept getting told at, you know, these festivals, is it's, you know, these stories where you don't know the outcome, so you don't know if this guy's going to get caught, you know, if he becomes a POW or what. First job in LA, gosh, I had saved up some money, so I knew that I had, you know, like 5 months to make it work, and I got a job reading scripts. I read scripts and did coverage for like a small production company that was trying to get going in Studio City. And that's use. That's the thing, is you got to find find the use in everything, right? So if you're reading 5-6 scripts a week, you start getting good at isolating what's good about this script, what's bad about this script. And I think that's a rite of passage for a lot of people out here. A lot of people do coverage on scripts. And so I did that.
It's hard to trust someone who hasn't.
Yeah, honestly, yeah. Like and it's something to bond over. You know, people sit down and talk about, you know, some of the famously bad scripts. And
Everyone who asks me for screenwriting advice, I say read a ton of scripts so you can see what you shouldn't do.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Even before LA, I would watch a movie, then I'd go read the script, or I'd go buy it at Barnes & Noble if they had, you know, the script published, or because it's just very interesting to see what makes a movie good and what makes a movie bad. You can usually spot it in the script if you're, you know, acute, if your awareness is acute enough. But so that's why I did that, and I was also hyper aware of the fact that, you know, a big part of this industry is networking. It's, you know, I don't say that with any. Some people say, "Oh, it's all who you know," and I said, "Well, yeah, you know." I mean, honestly, that works for a lot of industries. It's not exclusive to the entertainment business. It's, you know, it's networking. If you know, if you make good connections, and you know, you meet people, they're more prone to help you on your journey, you know. And so I would go to, you know, I would wake up early and go to Starbucks's all over the valley, you know, and just try and like find where the groups are, you know. And I wound up at this Starbucks and I met a great guy, Steve Shubin, who's a costumer, retired costumer, who had all kinds of great stories. I mean, he was Keaton's costumer in the Batman movies. He was Tom Hanks's costumer in Forrest Gump. He was Robin Williams's costumer on Jack. You know, like, he has great stories. So that just, I would just wake up every morning to go hear more, you know, and then.
And he was just hanging out at Starbucks.
Oh, he was just chilling. Yeah, just holding court.
And he loved having someone to talk, stories to.
Yeah, but, you know, and he had a bunch of buddies that that would come in too. And he introduced me to a guy named Scott Montoya, who is big in the stand-up comedy world. He directs a lot of really great stand-up comedy films. He's got a huge library, body of work. And, you know, eventually Scott, we'd known each other for, gosh, several months, maybe even a year. And Scott was doing Andrew Dice Clay's big comeback special. He hadn't done a special in 17 years. And he asked if I wanted to AD. You know, he goes, "Have you ever AD before?" And I said, "Yeah, of course, you know." but I had AD'd on, you know, these little projects. I don't know if Scott, he probably knew that. But I had AD'd on these little projects before. I'd never AD'd on, you know, a special that was, would eventually be sold to Showtime, you know. And so I learned a lot, cut my teeth on that. And then I did a short film. I AD'd on a short film called Marza, which Regan Young directed, who he's a producer on Catcher. So now the network's starting to build, right? Mm-hmm. So a friend that works with Scott introduced me to Regan, and I helped Regan AD for Regan on Marza, and kind of co-produced, but mostly AD'd. And I met Nate Fu, was the cinematographer on that, and he was the catcher on the DP.
I recognize the name.
Yeah. And so we all became pretty close friends. That was a really good set. That was one of those rare sets where everybody's just grooving, you know, everybody's just gelling. And Mars is based on a true story. It's about Regan's time in Iraq, in Afghanistan. He was a Marine. I almost said soldier. He corrects me on that all the time. It's Marine, not soldier. He was a Marine, and he put together this great film. And so we shot that. And then Regan introduced me to John, a friend from home, John Houston, who ran Footprint Productions, which is who produced The Catcher. So I think that catches us up to The Catcher, right?
It does. Although, just to ask about John, was Footprint just what he worked on, or
Footprint?
Did Footprint have a decent background?
Footprint was just getting started. I skipped one because I did a short film with John first that was animated called Tilly and the Moon that my mom wrote, actually. My mom is a preschool teacher, and she wrote this adorable short story thinking And she sent it to me thinking, you know, what are your thoughts on this? I want to go get this thing published. And I emailed her back and said, what do you think about me adapting this into a screenplay, you know? And I added some little things to make it more cinematic, you know, and I took that to John, and John really responded to it. And I think, you know, he was like, this is a great one to kind of dip our toes in with our relationship, you know? So we did this. It's so heartfelt. It's such an adorable little animation.
Talk about having an in with the author.
I know, right? Yeah. No, mom loved it. That was the ultimate, you know.
That'd have been great over Thanksgiving. You know, you wrecked my material.
You destroyed my work. Yeah. No, it was great. And so we did that, and that had a lot of success in the festivals. And from there, we did Catcher. That was the next step.
So the Catcher, was it a script you had in your back pocket for a while? Was it just an idea you knew about?
No.
Okay, so now answer the question. When did you first hear of Mo Burke?
The Catcher. My dad sent me an email about, you know, it was one of those chain emails, like stories you've never heard, you know, and it was just about Mo Burke and that trip to Japan he took with Murderers Row, you know, with Babe and Lou and all those guys. And I thought, well, man, that's phenomenal. That's right up my alley, right? It's historical. It's suspenseful. It's World War II, a big World War II fan. It's just well-rounded. It's a well-rounded story. It's got a little bit of everything. And immediately, the first thing I did was, you know, I was in my office and I just scribbled down as I was reading the email. I didn't even finish the email. I scribbled down what I thought the last scene of that movie would be. And it's what the last scene wound up being is him, you know, on the roof. And it's the reveal that, like, you know, this isn't a small mission. This guy, you know, took these pictures and it had this huge effect on history. And then I just drove over to, it was literally like, it was in one day. I just drove over to, John was producing a short at an apartment complex. They had taken over and they were shooting this, it was kind of a period piece that took place in like the 60s or something. And John, was just there. He was acting in it. He had a role in it. So he's just laying there on the couch in costume. And I go, John, I got one, man, you know, and we just talk it out and we decide that that's worth pursuing. So wrote the script and the rest is history. But yeah. So
he took to it and
we kind of co-wrote
clear that you were the, so you did co-write.
Well, yeah. I mean, I wrote it and we just went back. John and I have a great back and forth on stuff, you know, and it gets, because his mind works differently than mine does, we have similar likes and sensibilities. But his mind, goes to these like wacky creative places that my mind doesn't necessarily reach that corner, you know, and then I take him in another, you know, in kind of this like this very like story character direction too, you know, and so the merger of the two, we have a great back and forth, and so we went back and forth. I wrote the script and then he would, you know, give me some good notes on it. And yeah.
In fact, one of the things I noted upon repeated viewings of The Catcher, mm-hmm. because I'll admit to you, it's one of my go-tos when people are over at the house.
Oh, nice.
And they say, I want to see something from the festival, because not all your friends can come out, right?
Yeah.
In fact, not enough friends come out. And I will invariably show The Catcher.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Most of my favorites.
Yeah.
I'll qualify for that, too.
Yeah.
In fact, pretty much any film that gets involved in this podcast is going to be because I think that highly of it.
Why wouldn't it
but
be?
I always consider filmmaking, you know, an even balance between artistic ability and just straight up skill.
Yeah. Yeah.
Technical skill.
Yeah, totally.
And if you don't have the technical skill, you can't sit there and frame it right. You just can't fake skill.
Yeah, yeah.
Nor can you fake inspiration.
And part of that is surrounding yourself with people that have more skill than you, you know. That's a crucial element to it. But also, I think I'll add to your list, I think one of the biggest assets you can have, like in your personality, if you're on a set, is adaptability, man. People, you can't be rattled because it's, you know, if something's not going the right way, if the shot you had planned isn't going to work, you got to find a way to make a shot work that's just as good. You know, it's, you can't just be like, well, screw it, I'll do, you know, I'll just close in on it and we'll just move on to the next shot. You know,
no. In a very big way, the director's job
is support.
Yeah.
Is not just, you have to be supportive of everybody.
Get out of people's way. Yeah.
Yeah. Because if they don't feel supported, they can't give you the best work.
Totally. Yeah. So we found the location. We found we finished the script. We found the location. We started casting the crew. You know, getting. I knew Nate was going to be the first person I'd have to convince, my DP, because Nate's got a great eye and he's super persnickety about what he gets involved with. And so, so I took Nate to the Japanese garden, and we sat there for a couple hours in the sweltering heat of this outdoor garden, and just talked through shots and looks and vibes and tones and blocking and, you know, all the things. You know, where would we put the kabuki dancers? Where would we put the audience? Where, you know, where are lights going to go? And I think that really activated his interest in the project, and, you know, he was on board. We put together a great cast. You know, Keith Eady played Mo Berg, and Keith is a great guy. Keith, he normally has more comedic roles, and he came in and just turned in this really intense Mo Berg performance. And David Carey Foster,
yeah, he really chewed it up. You could tell he was enjoying himself.
I loved it. So that was one of the things. I think we talked about this at the Q&A, was that I wanted to invoke the period in the storytelling too, right? I didn't just want it to look period. I wanted it to feel, you know, Humphrey Bogart, Jimmy Stewart. Like, I wanted, like, I would tell him, I was like, I want a Jimmy Stewart performance, right? Like, I want it to feel like a movie that came out in this time period. And so, you know, we went for kind of these, you know, Keith kind of took this intense, you know, like, hard man route, you know, and it was great. You know, Mo Berg was definitely not that Humphrey Bogart, you know, but he was more of a dork, but I wanted it to feel, you know, it was great. Keith had a blast with that role. And then David, Carey Foster was the agent Schaefer.
Right. Seemed like the senior agent.
Yeah, the senior agent, who's kind of based loosely on William Donovan, who started the OSS. And he was just, he's a consummate professional. I mean, you know, David's been doing it forever. And so he just came in, and David's one of those actors that, you know, he'll look at a script and look at you and go, do I have to say this? Because I kind of say it with this blocking here. You know, you go, scratch it out, man, get rid of it. You know, he's really in tune to, you know, guarding his words, you know.
That's a funny example, because one of the things I love about your film and notice about it is there's three speaking parts,
yeah,
and probably well over 30 performers.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So much of it plays out like Japanese kabuki theater in a way. It's just,
yeah, that's a good point.
It's just theater of movement. I think it's very mature filmmaking. So it's interesting to me that one of your actors was like, "Let me say less."
Yeah, tone down
because,
the dialogue.
Because
yeah.
Your script was already probably very dialogue.
Yeah,
not dialogue free, but very light on dialogue.
Yeah.
How many pages was it?
Oh, God. I think, you know, I got really descriptive in the more thrilling sequences. So I think it was like a 16-page script, probably 16.
Right.
It's, but it's good. It's, I enjoy that. I enjoy the no dialogue thing. I think I enjoy letting the audience figure it out On that topic, you got to give them enough to figure it out, right? You don't want to just like drop them in and be like, well, if the audience is smart, they'll know what's going on. You know, it's, I always say, and I keep it in my pocket when I'm on a set, and I've done three shorts and a feature now. And it's always in my pocket. It says the director is the audience's representation on set. So that's my job, is to make sure that what we're doing translates to them, you know? And so basically another way of saying that is, you know, the story matters. And so does it serve the story? You know?
Yeah. Your job is to tell the story.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that, I think it's almost more fun, when you're not spoon fed something and you're watching it going, okay, I got to figure this out. You know, it hooks you in a little more. Now, if you go too far that direction, it's frustrating as hell, you know, because you're like, I don't know what the hell is going on in this movie, you know, and that's, you don't want that.
It's hard to think of examples of that, though.
I think a good example of somebody who did it well was in Inception. The first scene in Inception,
you've got no clue the rules of this world, you know, as people are appearing and disappearing, you know, people are dying and waking up in different places. But by the end of it, oddly, you kind of got to figure it out, you know. It's like you go, okay, cool.
So there's no limit to the number of times I can watch Inception.
Oh, God, it's brilliant in just, you know, showing and not telling when it could have been. That's a movie I would have given a pass for being really heavy on exposition, you know, like, and it's not. I mean, they have that one scene where he explains it to what's her face, to when Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Ellen Page, but even that, I mean, that scene is, you know, kind of buried in one of those Nolan three timeline montages, you know.
Yeah, which actually, coming back to The Catcher, you do an asynchronous timeline, which not a lot of people do well, but was it written that way the whole time?
Yeah, it was written that way. I mean, it's, you know,
in the editing room, you edit it yourself, so
I did cut it.
So did you make it even more asynchronous, or was it fully written that way?
I mean, for the only change that I made in the edit room was actually, it came from my brother, who's not in the film business at all. You know, he's getting his PhD right now, and he watched it and he goes, you know, it'd be cool if, because I told him, I was like, there's something about the ending that's just not hitting for me. Mm-hmm. And I love showing things to people and getting notes. Notes is one of my favorite parts of the experience. Even if I think, oh, I disagree with that. I still like to know how people are responding to something, you know. And he said, what if, you know, what if the timeline was sped up a little bit for Mo there at the end? And, you know, and it's so we're telling the story of Mo on the roof and Mo getting away with it at the same time, you know? And I said,
that came from your brother. 'Cause actually it is on this page of notes that he's safe back downstairs before we even see what he did up there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we actually know the tension's gone. It is great.
Yeah.
That is one of my favorite things is that I don't have to worry about him anymore. Yeah. I know he makes it back safely.
Yeah.
But I still don't know what he did up there.
It makes that mystery a payoff, you know, and rather than another obstacle, it's a payoff now, you know? And so I think that,
and in a way, in a short film, it really does feel like third act, too. Which normally in a short film, there's one act at most, not three.
Yeah.
But you have three.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, three locations, you know, like it's like three different color palettes. It's, you know, it's very 1, 2, 3. But yeah, it bounces around a little bit, and I like that. I was trying to figure out ways to keep it, you know, keep it entertaining and moving, because like you said, there is a lot of it that's silent, you know. So if we didn't bounce back to the warehouse, you would have felt that silence if we hadn't done that.
Maybe.
You know?
I don't know. Yeah. I'm not convinced. I love all the silent sequences. Not that I don't love when they're talking too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
it's fun.
I think it's just so strong and cinematic and dramatic. It just makes me, as I said to you after the screening at the festival, I just really want this to be longer. You know, that when you show the super at the end and the text mentions this was just one.
Yeah, I know.
You know, he did several missions, and he joked that he was a better spy than Catcher.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh,
I want to see him.
I could just see this guy taking, you know, doing the research. The way you handled the one mission.
Yeah.
I could absolutely see you stretching out a you know, 90 to 120 minute film.
I'd love to, man.
That arcs the story over several missions.
He's such a great character. And we've talked about it, and we've talked about maybe doing a series, you know. I mean, literally, he plays a role in the clandestine world until the end of the Cold War. He's there, you know, so it's, you know, his ripples are felt through the end of the Cold War. But
it's fascinating, which means the whole time he got away with it.
Yeah.
And the whole time he's still playing baseball, or was he doing it
post-baseball, too. But his baseball card is on display at CIA headquarters. It's, you know, so he's...
Is that the last shot of the feature? If you're doing
easily, yeah. I mean, yeah. We talked that through too. We were like, or we could do it. We could open with it and have it be a Saving Private Ryan thing where it's modern day. You know, sure. It could be. There's a million ways they could do it. I'm looking forward to seeing if this movie gets made. But
the odds are against it.
Yeah, I mean,
the odds are it'll be left untouched.
What was interesting to me about Mo's life is, I mean, it's so comprehensive, or so extensive that, you know, a movie almost won't do it justice, a feature film. I mean, it's just, that's why I got excited about maybe doing, maybe thinking about crafting this as a series, and maybe that's in the cards down the road, but, with The Catcher, what I did was I cut it, and then I sent out, I made a test audience questionnaire, and I sent it to about 60 people
in my 60. Network.
Yeah, I wanted everything, you know. I like it when people pick something clean to the bone, you know. I want to know where all my faults are, and then decide if I want to do something about it or
not.
That's
really brave, and that's so unusual. I mean, yeah. Sure, a couple confidants, but to just...
it was a huge...
So many people act like it's something precious that they don't, you know, I don't want too many people to see it.
No, for me, it's a learning experience, man. It's all about learning. And what's interesting is, I mean, you say, you know, one of the questions was, like, you know, who's your favorite character? Who's your least favorite character? And you'll get a third of the people will say... Moberg was my favorite. A third of the people say Moberg was my least favorite. A third of the people say, you know, Edmonds was my favorite. A third will say he's my least. It's just crazy. So you learn how you can't please everybody is the lesson to learn from that, right? So make the movie that you think is right. But then you get, you know, there'll be, if you were to plot all the notes out on a chart, you know, you'll get 80% of the people will say, you know, they'll comment something about the last beat, and they can't quite put their finger on it because they're not, you know, versed in film language, but they'll say, you know, oh, I think it's weird that this happened. And, you know, it's like, no, that's not what's weird about it. But I know what they're responding to. You know, it's, another great quote is Neil Gaiman said, when people tell you something's wrong, they're almost always right. When they tell you how to fix it, they're almost always wrong. You know, it's, you know how to fix it. Just try and triangulate the issue.
Right.
And
that's let them point out the problem.
Yeah. And that's what that was about. And I, you know, I've done that ever since on projects. I'll send it out to a crap ton of people and get feedback.
Good for you.
Yeah.
And you guys are working again on another project right now?
Yeah. Well, we did another huge short film after The Catcher that John wrote called Street Chips. And it is a behemoth of a project. And we shot it over the course of like 15 days. It has like everything you could imagine in it. You know, I learned a lot on Catcher, with, like, you know, working quick and working fast. And Catcher, we used Steadicam a lot, the Ronin, you know, the, and then we went to, Street Chips, and I've, you know, we worked with chase cars, rain machines, we shot on the Universal lot, you know, we had a techno crane, it's just like crazy stuff that, you know, it was literally a trial by fire learning how to, you know, appropriately maneuver all that. Because once you have that kind of a bag of tricks, you know, you want to use it. And so it's a super, it's very kinetic. The thing is shot very, very well. Nate Fu was out of town shooting something in Vietnam, I think. So we brought in a DP named Greg Cotton, who just nailed it, knocked it out of the park. And it's got this really cool aesthetic, but...
But this is a huge action picture that's a short.
Yeah.
It's just, it's over the top.
We just wanted to make a splash. What's nuts about it is that, so Catcher, we filmed Catcher in 2 days, right? Edited it, and it came out to be however long, whatever we decided, 13 minutes long. it's been a while. But the Street Chips, we shot in 15 days. With pickups and stuff. That's including pickups, which is a great luxury. I adore pickups. Didn't have that on Catcher. You know, that's like...
Yeah, you can't exactly get all the wardrobe back.
So we shot 15 days and packed it into about as much time as Catcher. Yeah, so the cut's currently sitting at about 12 minutes, 11 minutes. And so...
Right, so you're like a less than a day per minute.
Yeah, and so it is... It moves. Like, I mean, and it is, you know, every frame there's something to look at. And so I brought a lot of the experience from Catcher over... because we actually, believe it or not, really milked it. Like, you know, we did a lot... We were shooting a ton a day, you know. What's different between something like The Catcher and something like Street Chips is you don't realize how much time a car chase takes to film, you know. Like that, in your mind, you go, okay, well, we've got the street, we've got the cars, we've got the chase car,
you know, I'm just going to shoot this thing for 6 hours and
you'll have enough. You'll have multi-camera, right?
Yeah, yeah. And lo and behold, you know, it takes 6 hours just to get the camera running, you know, like it's just because you got, I mean, it's, and it rightfully so, it's safety. It's, you know, we got to go through it a bunch of times. We've got to map it out with the little toy cars first, you know, on the road, and you got to rig up the camera. I mean, it's just a chase car alone is a five-man operation. You know, you got a guy driving, a guy working the crane, a guy working the camera on the crane, a guy pulling focus, you know,
crane,
and then me just screaming in the in the back seat. But it's just it's great, it's a blast. But you know, I learned a lot about that on this one, about what, you know, some of these bigger ticket items really mean time wise and making sure that, you know, you get good looking stuff, you know, because it's like, oh well, anybody else would have taken 2 days to do that, and we did it in a day, so we're rushed. And you know, so it's, you know, so there was still kind of that rushed mentality. It was just because we were doing bigger stuff, you know. It wasn't because we had held ourselves to 2 days,
right? And you guys chose to do this one. John wrote it, but you thought you'd just swing for the fence.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, John wrote it, and we just wanted to make something.
Okay, this is a massive undertaking.
Yeah, we wanted to make a splash.
We are up for it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that was, John had done a couple shorts, I'd done a couple shorts, and I think we were kind of like, you know, okay, we know how to work, you know, we know how to place a camera, we know how to tell a story. It's time to jump up a level, you know, graduate to a next. And so we did that, and we just learned a lot on this one. And I think, you know, and I'm still learning. We're in post right now doing visual effects for it. And that's, mm-hmm. that is, you know, mind boggling. Yeah. And what I'm learning is that those kind of like lone wolf VFX guys are the way to go, you know, at this level. You know, it's
remarkable that, a person at home can compete with the studios.
Yeah, I mean, the technology is there now, and it's just, you know, these guys that just drink a lot of Red Bull and make this awesome looking stuff. But you know, a lot of them are working. They'll get called into the big, you know, where you've got 100 developers.
Yeah, so they have to put you. They're like, look, I'm doing your thing, but I'm going to do the cash cow here, and I'll give you like 5 hours a week.
Yeah,
and why not say yes?
Which is totally fine. Yeah, I'm happy to do that. And also, you know, if they're doing that, they're learning stuff and maybe, you know, borrowing some stuff from what they're doing for this big movie, you know, and
possibly
applying it to your movie. So, which is great.
I just remembered a friend of mine did all the fangs in True Blood.
Oh,
just
wow.
The fangs.
That's
just
crazy.
Fangs. He didn't do the other digital
Isn't that
effects.
Nuts?
He was the fang guy.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, I was such a moron.
Yeah.
Because I thought there was like a spring-loaded kind of vibe with that. But no, it's just digital.
Yeah. 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 It's wild to watch. I follow a couple different Instagram accounts that are all about VFX. And you just, you know, they do the before and afters. And it's nuts how seamless it is now. What's nuts is that in the time since shooting it, I've done a feature. That's literally
a whole feature
in the post process of Street Chips.
Because the digital side of the post is taking so long.
Yeah,
just
the learning curve on that one was longer than we thought it would be. We took our time figuring out how to find these guys and how much.
So you've got a computer with the final cut or with the cut of Street Chips going.
Yeah,
and the whole time that's going, you wrote. And shot and are now editing a feature?
yeah. That was a blast, man. That was great. And a lot of the guys that worked on Street Chips came and worked on this because I felt like, you know, Tom Sawyer in the fence, because my excuse to them was like, hey, we've done this huge short film, you know, we've spent all this money on it. Let's go do a feature for nothing. Wouldn't that be fun, guys?
Sure. Well, and how long was the feature shoot?
The feature shoot, we did it over 3-day weekends for 5 weeks. So it was 15 days.
See, there you go. The same length as the
show. Same length of Street Chips. And the feature's called This Is My Year. And it was all shot in my apartment at the time. So it's kind of this, it's a single location. It's more out of necessity. We you know, we weren't trying to get gimmicky with it, but it was just like, hey, we're not going to be able to go out and shoot locations. And, so, you know, we brought in, it was hilarious. I mean, my apartment was bedlam, like just total. Cause we brought in, you know, good gear. Like we were renting from like Able Cine and, you know, so we had
all these C-stands and lights and cameras and, you know, and this little two-bedroom apartment in K-Town. And God bless our downstairs neighbors. I don't know how they did it, but they never ratted us out. And we shot this...
I hope you shared some pizza with them or something.
Yeah. No, they were getting Starbucks gift cards dropped at the door. But it was great. I wrote it with... R.J. Haynes wrote it, who's a brilliant writer. He's so funny. This was my first time working with, like, a writer, right? Like a guy who... His craft is writing, and what I learned was I am not a writer. Because I had adapted Tilly and the Moon, I'd written Catcher, I'd helped write Street Chips, but I did what John did on Catcher for Street Chips. So yeah, hopefully that one's done right around the time Street Chips is going to be done. They're probably going to both.
You'll be out in the
festival sphere.
You'll click the mouse the last time for both within the same
month, probably. I'm looking forward to it, but it's
that's going to make you appear to be a highly productive person.
Yeah, I know, right? Like, little do they know, right? it's Street Chips. I think I got involved with Street Chips 2 years ago. That's when we first started talking about it. So it's been a ride. You know, it's probably going to be 2.5 years of working on that from development to finishing it. So
sounds normal for an independent.
Honestly,
sounds normal for anything, actually, not just independent.
Yeah that's a good point. But it's fun. It's definitely fun, man. And now we're just looking for the next one.
Alright, cool. Well, it was great having you in for the maiden voyage.
Yeah, I was happy to do it, dude. I love this. I love that you're doing this. And
good to see. I know. Well, you know, the Q&As of the festival are just way too abrupt.
Yeah.
There's
lots of passes.
Everyone enjoys the festival, and it's a great thing.
Yeah.
But there's not enough time in between films to chat out on the sidewalk about what you just saw.
Yeah.
Not enough time to discuss it with the filmmaker, with the, you know.
Yeah, yeah, you got to find him at a bar that night or something. It's you're right. There's no time to really chat.
You know, in an ideal world, you'd have 1 hour right after every film. But if you don't own the theater,
good luck.
The trains must keep leaving the station.
Yeah, that hour costs money.
Yeah.
No, well, that's good. I mean, I'm glad you're doing it, man. And we had a blast at Film Invasion, and when we did it, and we've kept in touch with people that we met there too. So that's
cool.
Great. Yeah,
all right.
Got a lot of business cards.
Well, you got to come to Sherman Oaks Film Festival.
For sure. Sherman Oaks. I've heard good things about Sherman Oaks Festival.
I've heard wonderful things.
So maybe you'll see. Maybe Street Chips is gonna. Hopefully, when it gets done, I will never say if it gets done. When it gets done, Street Chips will be at Sherman Oaks Festival for sure. So
there you go.
Yeah.
All right. I'm gonna hit the space bar. We'll get out of this.
There you have it, the first episode ever of the Discover Film Podcast. Again, you can watch Jamie Brindle's film The Catcher by going to discoverfilm.net. For info about the festival where I first met Jamie, you can go to filminvasionla.com. And if you want to learn more about me, just hit the website jeffhoward.me. I think that's it. Thanks for listening. Until next time, get out there and discover film.